I'm Dr. Scott Lyons, and you're watching or listening to The Gently Used Human. Have you ever considered the power of laughter in battling anxiety? Or wondered if anxiety is not just a state of mind, but also a condition deeply rooted in our bodies? And most importantly, if it's possible to unravel the complexities of anxiety and find solace in the present moment? Well, in today's intriguing episode, we're joined by Dr. Russell Kennedy, also known as the Anxiety MD. With his unique blend of expertise in medicine, neuroscience, and stand-up comedy, Dr. Kennedy offers a revolutionary approach to understanding and overcoming anxiety. He shares insights from his personal journey, revealing how comedy served as a counterphobic tool against his anxiety and how this intersects with his medical practice. Dr. Kennedy challenges the conventional view of anxiety, redefining it as a physical state of alarm that often stems from an unresolved trauma. He guides us through techniques to connect with our inner self and finds a sense of safety in the present. We explore the essential difference between everyday discomfort and lingering trauma and how focusing on the body's alarm signals can pave the way to healing. Let's get this going. Dr. Russell Kennedy, welcome to the Gently Used Human, my friend. We are so excited to have you here with us.
Dr. Scott Lyons, I am feeling the same way.
Now, I don't know very many other doctors who are also have a background in stand-up comedy. So I feel like we might be long lost twins in our lifetime.
Maybe. I mean, I think it is two different parts of your brain. There's that left-sided analytical linguistic side, and then there's that right-sided kind of artistic, hey, look at me kind of thing, right?
That histrionic side.
Yeah. There's a real dichotomy with me. Part of me loves being seen and part of me just hates it. Yeah. I think doing stand-up comedy for 10 years, it was kind of like a counterphobic response to me. Like I'm afraid of people. I'm afraid of crowds. Had a little bit of bullying through school. So it's like crowds make me pretty uneasy, but it was my way of kind of like Freud's repetition compulsion. It's like put yourself in that reenactment, as you call it in your book, right? Put yourself in that reenactment and see how it goes. And there were some nights, I mean, I remember in Cranbrook, I had to do stand-up comedy at a funeral. But it wasn't meant to be a funeral, right? So I toured with Yuck Yucks, which is the big comedy company in Canada. So we did this bar, like you would do these pop-up bars, right? They would have comedy night, right? So this particular comedy night, they had a funeral across the street and about 40 people from the funeral went into the bar and started drinking around like 1:30 in the afternoon. Show starts at 9:30. So you can imagine, oh, it was just mayhem. It was just like...
What kind of funeral goer heckling did you have to deal with?
Well, they just wanted to talk amongst themselves, right? They just wanted to... It's like Mike Myers, you know, talk amongst yourselves. But they were so loud and they were right in the middle of the venue too. So people actually came for the comedy show that sat around the periphery. So there was Howie Miller, who's a native comic, who's brilliantly funny. And Ryan Patterson, who's also brilliantly funny, and me, who's okay. I was the host, so I had to go up first and take the bullet. So we were trying to move them. You know, would you guys mind moving to the back or whatever? It's like, screw you. I'm using language that they didn't quite use. They were a little more effusive in their language. Man, that was a tough gig. That's what on the road for comedy. Like when you do small towns, like it's just a crap. It can be amazing. Because they just appreciate the big city and all those funny people from the big city. Or, you know, it can go really badly.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. Yeah.
Who's this uppity doctor guy doing comedy?
So you were already a doctor.
Yes.
Doing stand-up comedy. Oh, okay. I did it the reverse way where I brought comedy into my sessions with patients.
And I tried to as well, but you have to read the room. My little internal thing was if they make the first joke, I can go from there. But unless they make the first joke, I gotta be Dr. Kennedy.
Yeah, it's a hard line sometimes to know because comedy is medicine. Comedy is medicine. I will say absolutely.
Well, they say laughter is the best medicine for sure, unless you have chlamydia, and then laughing. Is not really going to help you. You can laugh all you want. It's still going to burn when you pee, right?
So yeah, then you need some type of antibiotics. Yeah.
Doxycycline is the best for chlamydia. Yeah.
Oh, doxy. Almost as good as humor. Or sometimes better.
Sometimes better because you can laugh all you want. If you have chlamydia, you can laugh and laugh and laugh for days, weeks, months at a time, and it's still going to burn, right? So
yeah,
this is a great start.
This is a great start.
People are going, geez, well, I wanted to learn something about my psyche, and it's just comedy from start to finish.
They thought we were going to talk about anxiety, but here we are talking about chlamydia.
Screw that. Let's talk about the anxiety you get from having chlamydia.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I wouldn't know.
Okay.
Yeah. But do tell. What's it like?
Well, it's not that fun. It's not that fun. Speaking from long lost experience, this is years ago. But I knew what it was, and I knew how to treat it, so I didn't have to go see anybody, because it was just like, well, we got this in the cupboard. I'll just see if this works, and it did. So that's probably what it was.
That after show activities, the folks who stay after your shows, and they're, you know, keen to be a groupie.
They've been drinking, and yeah, that drinking. Kind of stuff. You look
You've
a lot
been
better after
mildly
a few
funny.
Drinks.
It's romantic.
Exactly.
How did you go from doctor to comedy to comic to doctor again? Just
well, I did it at the same time. So basically what I would do is I would work the urgent care clinic in downtown Vancouver, and I had day shifts because I had built up some seniority there. And then I would just go and do the clubs at night. Like, we had a bunch of clubs in Vancouver. We had Yuck Yucks. There's Laugh Lines. It's just outside of Vancouver. We had a bunch of clubs. So, and then we had all these pop-up venues too. So I'd finish my shift around 3 because I did the 9 to 3 thing. And then the shows would start around 8:30 or 9. And they pay you in beer, which is bad. So they give you, you know, you come on stage. I mean, the bigger show, the like Yuck Yucks, like the major venues pay you cash for sure. But the smaller little sort of pop-up venues, there was one called the Urban Well there that Robin Williams used to show up at quite a bit when he was filming a movie in Vancouver. I got to know Robin Williams a little bit, which was great. He used to call me Doc. So he would come in and we'd have a little chat about our daughters. And you know, he's no stranger to anxiety, nor was I at the time. I have a little picture with him and that kind of thing. And just, yeah, it was just a really nice, it's a nice outlet. You know, when you're in that left brain kind of buttoned down, and you have to have this certain persona as a doctor. And then people would be uncomfortable with me as a comedian, because in a way, as a comedian, you're kind of like their servant in a way. You're like their entertainer in a way. And then you're their doctor. So it's like you're kind of above them and below them at the same time, right? So it's a really interesting kind of thing. And some people just wouldn't like it. Not that I was overly dirty. I mean, I didn't tell a lot of chlamydia jokes back then, but there was a few.
You saved them all for today.
Yeah, exactly. And people get used to pigeonholing people in a certain role. And if you're outside of that, they really get a little strange.
It does mess with people.
They get a little dramatic, to use your...
They get a little dramatic. Yeah. As I was a therapist during the day at that point, and then doing drag stand-up at night, it was maybe a little uncomfortable for folks.
Yeah. Well, you got to balance, right? Like you got to look after yourself in a lot of ways. And I think stand-up for me was kind of the saving grace. I was burning out of medicine very early. So stand-up gave me just a little relief valve so that I could go back and go in and do. And plus, as a doctor, you know, I really had this feeling at a consciousness perspective that I wasn't really helping people. Like, just other than the chlamydia, I mean, you know, you fix that, they're grateful. But, you know, chronic illnesses, emotional things, I mean, basically it's, as my uncle Colin from Scotland says, it's kind of like the order of the rotating pen. Like, you come in with anxiety, depression, eating disorder, whatever it is, and basically you walk out with a prescription. And there was a real crisis of conscience for me. And I think that's why a lot of medical doctors are burning out, because they're realizing, hey, I'm not really going at the root cause of this. I'm just giving you something to mask a symptom. And then there's side effects from the medication, which we have to give you different medications for. And it just becomes this cycle. And it was very dissatisfying for me, because one of my little spidey senses is I can see where your trauma is. I can see where you hold it in your body. I can see where it comes from. Like, sometimes I'll see visions of you actually being spanked, or not you, but maybe, who cares? But I would see these things, and then I've got 7 minutes just to someone who's been like physically, emotionally, sexually abused. And it's like, what do you do with that? Like, you can't, all you can do is give them a medication and kind of reassure them as best you can, because you can't get into that trauma, because as soon as you open up that can of worms, that's an hour, you know, and I've got 30 people waiting for me to see me that day. So it was a real... That's why I burned out of medicine. That's why I had to leave, because I just felt like I wasn't doing what I needed to do. And now I get to spend like 90 minutes with people if I want.
Mm. At any point, was there any crossover of the material you were focusing on in your practice and the material that was coming up in your stand-up?
Well, I mean, I did this joke about we go out to the waiting room and we call people in by their names. And I thought what it would be like to sort of go out and call people in by their ailments. Go out and say, pneumonia. Who's got pneumonia? Okay. Premature ejaculation. Who's the premature ejaculator? I don't remember exactly my rhythm at the time and that sort of stuff, but it sounds like I did a lot of sex jokes, which I didn't. But it was just poking fun at the medical community. That's what I was kind of doing. And just sort of, I didn't know it at the time, but just showing the inefficiencies. Because I know so many people who have been in therapy and everybody I know has had a bad experience with a medical doctor. Everyone I know. There's no person I know that hasn't had a bad experience with a medical doctor. So it is one of those things that I try to be connected to people. And I think that was hard, being connected to 30 or 40 people in a day and then feeling their trauma and feeling their pain and seeing the people that came in with a bunch of drama, the people that would come in over and over and over again with the same kind of issues.
Yeah, I think, I don't know if it's the same for you, but like what I found was all those skills I had developed through doing improv and stand-up comedy really translated over into working with patients. It's like the ability to be in flow with them as opposed to having some prescription type dialogue skills, like this is what you say when they say this, but actually be more fluid and in the moment really made me a much better practitioner.
Because yeah, I think you're actually getting into the emotional part of their system, right? Because we're all shielded. We all have a certain kind of persona that we put out to the world. Or I'm writing this article right now called Persoma. So N instead of an M instead of an N. Because how our body feels is how our personality is going to come up. Like if you're feeling great in your body, you're probably going to be close to your real authentic self. But if you're feeling anxious or depressed or scared about something, you're going to develop this defensive personality, which isn't really who you are. And I think a lot of what we do in helping other people is sort of how can we move from their defensive accommodations into a place of realness while they're still feeling safe. You know, you can't shove them in too early, and then get at the real issue, the real heart of the matter, as opposed to just kind of like superficially dealing with their complaints. And I think in medicine, we kind of lean towards superficially dealing with their complaints. And I think it just was the main reason I burned out, for sure.
Yeah. Your work now, which is that you have been working towards redefining the understanding and the treatment of anxiety. I mean, you're the anxiety MD.
Yeah.
Trademark. Let's deconstruct the shit out of that. What is the classical concept of anxiety, and what is your redefining it? Or redefinition of it?
Yeah, the classical look at anxiety is, or diagnosis is, a disorder of the mind. Just excessive thoughts, hyperreactivity. And I reframe that in saying it's really a state of alarm that's held in the body. Now, we can't separate the mind and the body. It's a great construct to say, hey, we hold trauma in our bodies. And I think that to some extent, that's true. It may be that we actually hold the trauma in the insular cortex in our brain. So it's the representation of our body that holds this trauma. So I have this little theory that when you experience a trauma when you're 3, 5, 7, 12, whatever years old, that it creates a certain feeling state in your body through the insula, through the amygdala. And that feeling state is replicated in your adult life as well. So if you were, say, had parents that were yelling at each other all the time when you were 7 years old, and then you're in a grocery store and in the other aisle, you hear a couple like arguing, your body will feel exactly the same way then as you did at 7 years old. And then when your body feels the same way, the mind, which is just a compulsive meaning-making, make sense machine, will probably think similar thoughts to how you did at 7. Now, of course, you know, you've had a lot of life experience when you become an adult, but really it's amazing how childlike we become. And on top of that, we don't notice it. So redefining anxiety as this alarm that we hold in our system that's only really reflected by the mind. So it's kind of like looking in the mirror and trying to reach into the mirror and change the reflection. It's like we're trying to fix the wrong thing in mainstream psychiatry and psychology, because we're trying to change the thoughts, but the thoughts are just the byproduct. They're not the actual cause of the problem. The cause of the problem is this old trauma that's held in our body that's reflecting through the mind. And that repetition compulsion we talked about just a few moments ago is that whatever was normal for you as a child, you will reproduce and reenact, as you say in your book, unconsciously, because you will get a dopamine hit from that because it feels familiar. And that human beings equate familiarity with security. So to go back full circle, I believe that anxiety is much more of an issue of old unresolved alarms and traumas that are still held inside of you that are only reflected by your mind rather than it being a disorder of the mind in and of itself.
Mm-hmm. Now, and are we talking about an anxiety disorder versus everyday anxiety, or is that the same?
It depends. I mean, I think, you know, if you look at the attachment models, if you had secure attachment, I think that we all experience anxiety. Like everyone experiences anxiety.
Yeah.
But if it's a daily, part of your life where you're always worried, I know in the first part of your book and when you're talking to Nicole about this, you're saying, you know, I always felt like bad things happened to me. And it's true, like bad things happen to all of us in life. And one of the things that I would notice, my dad was schizophrenic and bipolar. So bad things would happen. He would go schizophrenic. He was never abusive or violent, but he would lose his mind, either go depressed or manic. And it was very uncomfortable for, you know, the oldest boy in the family to see his dad go nuts like that. So there was this chaos. And sometimes he'd be fine for 12 or 18 months before another schism would happen. So in my little brain, it was like, well, don't get too comfortable because this is all going to go to shit again. So just, you know, keep yourself at a hypervigilant level so that you're ready for it. And the number of times that I thought, oh, he's going into mania, he's going into depression, and he never did. So it just shows the mind, that confirmation bias of the mind, like looking for the next problem. So if you're always looking for the next problem, you're going to feel like life is problem, 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 problem. When really it's problem, 12 months, if you're lucky. Another problem, 18 months, another problem. That's not how our survival-based minds work. They want to keep us alive. So they just say, you have to be hypervigilant. You have to always watch out for this because this is coming.
Yeah. And we know that the hypervigilance, the seeking, the looking for the information that could prove what it is that we are afraid of or concerned about is that we will find anything to confirm it, as you're talking about, that confirmation bias. So hypervigilance isn't just an attentional issue. It's also that we receive and take in what we're looking for, even if it's not there.
Totally. And then plus, you know, if you look at the way the dopaminergic system works in the brain and nucleus accumbens and stuff, like it wants to find something because when it finds, it's kind of like comedy. You know, comedy is something that doesn't make sense and then all of a sudden it makes sense. Same thing with addiction to drama, same thing with anxiety, is that we're looking for it. So when it shows up, it lights up like a neon sign and we ignore the good stuff because our brains are so programmed to be hypervigilant towards the bad. So we give so much more credibility to the bad stuff than the good. And this is just the normal human brain in general. But if you throw trauma into that, we start focusing on the negative because we believe that that's keeping us safe. And it's doing the opposite.
Yeah. And here's the juicy part is that the space between, that liminal space between the seeking or the searching for the next potential threat or trauma and the actual finding it, that to me is the height of anxiety. That's that discomfort, that preparation, and yet there's nothing to grasp onto that's tangible. So it's that discomfort, that inability or the lack of capacity to be with the unknown, because the known of what we're looking for and seeking hasn't arrived to us yet.
Right. Or even if it was there, we don't see it. And this is your concept of revving. Right? Like, it's just like, okay, I don't feel comfortable with the calm. I don't feel comfortable when things are good because when I was a child, the other shoe always dropped. So there's this revving. And I remember reading that and I thought, oh yeah, that's so good. I love that term, revving. And I've been using it with my people as well. And then I have this image, like, you know, a tachometer, like in non-electric vehicles, and it goes up and there's the red line when you get to 6,000, 7,000, 8,000. It's like, okay, the first stage is revving and then you go red line. And then when you go red line, basically the pistons explode and the engine explodes. And this is what you're talking about. The whole thing goes up. And then there's this period of like, okay, you're sitting there in a car that's exploded going, okay, I'm going to find another car. So it's just the cycle just keeps going on. So when you were talking about revving, it's like, yeah, I just imagine a tachometer going up. And then from inside of us, we fire that thing up to the red line so that there's a huge explosion. Our engine explodes. And then there's the guilt and the boredom and all that. And the whole cycle repeats itself again. So I really love that part.
Thank you. I want to take a moment to give a loud shout out to The Embody Lab, which is one of the most incredible resources for body-based and somatic therapies. This show is all about healing, and The Embody Lab does exactly that. Whether you're on your own journey of transformation and discovery, or enhancing your skill sets in your career as like a coach or a therapist, a body worker, or really any career where you are supporting other gently used humans, The Embody Lab is your place for deep, inspiring, and impactful workshops, certificates, masterclasses, and an incredible community of like-minded folks. I love The Embody Lab, and so do so many other people that call it a platform to come home to over and over again. The Embody Lab is giving my listeners an exclusive offer, a one-time 10% off code to enhance your embodied well-being. All you have to do is go to theembodylab.com and use the code GENTLYUSE10 at checkout. I think about one other thing, and I'm curious your thoughts on this, is I often have referred to, and I think I did it in the book as well, I referred to anxiety as simply signaling. And for some, and that's a tool I've used with clients to like settle it down, because sometimes they have anxiety about the anxiety. And I mean, it's like in the same way we are so afraid of sleeping that we won't sleep, that we don't sleep. And that cycle continues and continues. But, you know, there's something about, I think I gave this example in the book, that when my nephew was younger and I was studying for my board exams, so I was pretty preoccupied and overwhelmed. He was trying to get my attention and get my attention and get my attention. And I just didn't even hear him, to be honest, or see him. And then he just punched me in my genitals. And like when he did that,
sorry for laughing.
It's funny. I mean, he got my attention. He won. And I just looked up and was like, hey, buddy, what's going on? And I didn't want to, I wasn't going to punish him. He clearly needed something. And that was his mode of, you know, communication at the time. And he was like, I've been calling your name. And it was such an interesting point for me of like, oh my gosh, in our body, when there is a signaling and it keeps calling for our attention and calling for our attention and calling for our attention, and we don't pick up the phone, it's going to keep getting louder and more violent to the point in which we start to experience things like panic attacks or disease. And for me, that was like, okay, so one of the ways I've been working with people around anxiety is like, how do we get to the point where we just pick up the phone? And what does that relieve in our bodies to tune in and listen, as opposed to something inside of us having to keep cranking up the volume of intensity of those signals until we pay attention?
Yeah, it is a signal from your body. You know, in my book, I talk about background alarm. So if you had like emotional, physical, sexual trauma as a child, you still hold that. And it still revs, to use one of your terms, below the surface. And you can be having a good time with your friends and it's not apparent, but when things go wrong, when you start getting stressed, when your parents are getting sick, when you have a breakup, you know, when your pet dies, you know, this stuff starts to bubble up to the surface. So that signal, so we have two choices at that point that maybe we're not aware of. One is to become aware, hey, where is this in my body? Can I connect with it? Because I believe that that alarm in our bodies, for me, it's in my solar plexus. And I found that on LSD, and we can drop into that if you want at some point.
I'd love to drop an LSD with you.
Yeah, exactly. Drop LSD. It seems to go together. So what I do is I find the alarm in my body, and it's usually in the midline. If you look at the way the default mode network in the brain works, it's midline. So it usually, anxiety issues, emotional issues will usually reflect somewhere in the midline between your chin and your pubic bone. Now, it can be anywhere. So we have this choice of actually going in and being aware and go, oh, rather than going up into my mind and just having 1,000 different permutations of what this could be, why don't I just stop for a second, go into my body, put my hand over it, breathe into it. And it's not like that's going to fix it right away, but there is a sense that you are actually dealing with the root cause of the issue, because in your head, you're never going to find it there. It's like looking for peanut butter in a hardware store. You're not going to find it there. Stop looking for it there. It's not going to be there. So it's like, can you, rather than going up into your head, which is your automatic dissociative response, which is probably what it was as a child, you know, your only response as a child when your parents are treating you badly or rejecting you or abandoning you is to go into your head or is to dissociate. So what I tell people is, can we find that alarm in your body, and can we focus on that? And, you know, put your hand over it, breathe into it. And it sounds kind of woo for a medical doctor, for sure, because sometimes I want to have a seizure when I talk about this stuff, because it sounds so antithetical to how I was trained as a neuroscientist and a doctor. But it actually gets to the root cause of the problem, because as soon as you go into your head, you've lost. You've lost the game. It's like those carnival midway games where you throw a ring over a Coke bottle or try to knock over five heavy things with a ball. Like it's rigged against you. Like you're not going to win that game. The only way to win that game is not to play it. So I teach people, go into your body, find it in your body, even if it's uncomfortable, because likely it's going to be. And it is, that's the signal. And on top of all that, that signal is basically your younger self, that insular-based, amygdala-based recording of the trauma that's still in your body. Find that, resonate with that, and then you can change the root cause. But if every time, if you have the issue in your body, for me, it's in my solar plexus, and every single time I go up into my head and I'm in my head and the problem's in my body, I never actually deal with the root cause of the problem in my body. So that's my fundamental sort of theory, is that this is old trauma that's held in the body. It's a version of your younger self that doesn't feel seen, heard, protected, or loved. So see it, hear it, protect it, and love it, and show it that way rather than try to fix your thoughts, because it just doesn't work. Like, and I get a little down on CBT, which is the gold standard according to the medical profession of anxiety treatment. And it works. CBT actually works, but it doesn't stick. Whereas more somatic therapy takes a longer time, but it actually provides this fertile ground for both the body to regulate itself and the mind to regulate itself in response to that, because it's much more effective to regulate your body, to regulate your mind, than it is to try and regulate your mind, to regulate your body. That was a bit of a rant, but...
No, and for those who are listening, CBT is cognitive behavioral therapy. I appreciate that there are tools that you can address that we can use in the moment that might mitigate some of the pulse, the throbbing, the discomfort, what are words that you would use to describe, because you write about your own history with anxiety.
Oh, sure.
Look, so many of us know what anxiety is, but that doesn't mean we know or recall what it feels like so deeply. Like, we might have the overwhelming sense of it, but like the textures of anxiety, what was that like for you?
Well, it was just an overwhelming sensation. And I think I got distracted because my go-to was to dissociate. Still is when I get alarmed. Like, I will still start zombie scrolling Instagram, and Cynthia, my wife, will come in and she'll go, "You feeling like alarmed today?" And it's like, yeah. It's just like, how do you know? It's like, well, you've been on that thing. You've been scrolling something for the last 20 minutes and you haven't really, maybe she should have punched me in the balls at that point just to get my attention. But it was kind of like, it's like, oh yeah, like I fell into it again. And I think that's part of it too, because here's the thing, right? We have these big prefrontal cortices, these big front parts of our brain that have our executive functions in it. But when we get into survival physiology, when we start secreting norepinephrine in our brain and the HPA axis creates all this adrenaline in our bodies and cortisol as well, we paralyze that cognitive part of our brain. So going back to cognitive behavior therapy, which I think is very helpful, I'm not down on it. It's just, it's not going to heal you. It'll help you cope, but it's not going to heal you. So when we actually paralyze the cognitive part, the rational thinking part of our brain, because from an evolutionary perspective, we didn't need that when we were being chased by a warring tribe or chased by an animal. We needed our emotional brain to kick in and keep us alive. We still have that. We still have that Stone Age brain in a digital world. So we paralyze the rational thinking part of our brain. So why are we trying to go into the thinking part of our brain and worry and solve the problem when it's not actually a thinking problem? It's actually a feeling problem. So what I try and teach people is, okay, One of the things that I'll say is if you wake up in the middle of the night and you're panicked about something that's, because worry is always about the future. It's never about what's happening now. It's always about some projection of the future. And I say, and this is what my daughter has said, the most important thing that she said when it comes to dealing with her anxiety is, am I safe in this moment? Or you can say, I am safe in this moment. You know, put your hand on your chest, breathe in and say, I'm really freaked out about this, but in this moment that I'm in right now, am I safe? And then on top of that, it's like, can I find the younger version of me that's actually creating this problem in the first place? That's a bit of a, you know, that's an advanced move. Like when they say in yoga classes, like, now melt all the muscles off your face. It's like, well, that's an advanced move. I can't quite do that one yet. But it's really about finding that younger version of you, because 90% of anxiety, you know, chronic anxiety, people that have, like, we all have anxiety every day, like every human being does. But chronic anxiety, the stuff that just keeps coming and coming and coming, that's old alarm that just isn't being processed. So we need, and we're not going to process it by thinking about it. We're going to process it by feeling, you know, and you and I are both SEPs, so somatic experiencing practitioners. So we know the power of the body when it comes to resolving this issue, as opposed to just trying to fix the mind over and over again.
So how are we discerning, to go back to an earlier question, between like the everyday kind of discomfort with the unknown versus more of like this inner child, early trauma sort of lingering, kind of that alarm?
Basically, the question I ask people is, are you happy with your life?
Does anyone say yes?
Some people do. Some people do. But I mean, not the population I typically see. Though, like, or, you know, the way I phrase it is, in general, though, are you pretty happy with your life? And people will say, yeah, yeah. But people with anxiety tend to like, well, I'm always worried about something. You know, I think you talked about this with Nicole too. Like, there's always, I call it the worry bucket. There's always something in the worry bucket. And if there's nothing in the worry bucket, that's very disconcerting for a lot of people, because that was their way. So if you always have to bring yourself down. If something's really nice is happening in your environment, your spouse is having a birthday or whatever, and you're thinking, well, geez, I hope they don't get caught in a car crash when I, oh, no, wait. Like, you're probably on that anxious spectrum. And I think COVID, I think a lot of people were kind of treading water with anxiety before COVID. And then COVID just everybody, you know, it put everybody into this place. Whereas if you were coping before, you're not really coping that much now. So it's really kind of, how much of it does it affect your day-to-day life? You know, are you always looking for the negative? You know, that's one of the big signs. That's one of the big, depression too, but one of the big signs of anxiety is, and not being able to rest, like not being able to just go into that sort of low tone dorsal kind of like, okay, I'm calm. Life is good. Things are okay. Like, it's chapter 62 of my book is when it's...
Did you just say 62?
Yeah, I know. It's written on 108 short chapters.
Oh, that's right.
So it's kind of like Eat, Pray, Love, right?
Eat, Pray, Love for Anxiety.
Eat, Pray, Love for Anxiety. When I read that book, and it's not very macho for guys to say, I love that, Eat, Pray, Love, but I really did. And I thought, man, if I write a book, I'm going to write it in 108 short chapters, which is basically what this is. So chapter 62 is when you feel worried when you're not worrying, when it's not safe to feel safe.
And are you doing 108 because it's also a very auspicious number?
Yes. Absolutely. Yeah.
So like 108 sun salutations. And yeah.
Yep. Exactly. 108 diameters of the moon to the earth and all this kind of stuff. Yeah. So I do have my woo side. There's no two ways about that. I can go pretty woo.
I love how the woo structures the content of like the neuroscience.
I need to throw it in there. Like, I, every once in a while, like if I'm talking to professionals like doctors and stuff like that, I'll have to say, well, if we're looking at the bed nucleus of the striatum terminalis and how it really focuses on the cognitive aspects of worrying and how that affects the anterior cingulate cortex and how that affects in turn mediating the amygdala, then they'll take it. Like then I can, after that, if I say that for a while, then they'll kind of go, oh, I can go a little woo. I've earned my woo credits at that point. But if I just go up there and go, oh, you have to find the alarm in your body and you really have to breathe into it. If I said that to a bunch of doctors, my God, I would just be ridiculed forever.
I get it. It's you gotta titrate the entrance to their style.
And speak in their language, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So you had some severe anxiety through your life. And you, one of the ways that you dealt with it is somatics. And another way you've dealt with it is psychedelics.
Yeah.
So can you walk us through sort of your healing process?
Right. So 2013, February 8th of 2013, I ruptured my left Achilles tendon. And I was already burned out of medicine. I was working in a clinic. I was doing stand-up. I was working in a clinic in downtown Vancouver. And it was like, okay, I'm out. Like, I can't. It's like Gabor Mate is when the body says no. It's like, no, you're not doing this anymore. And it's funny because your Achilles allows you to move forward. And it was like, you're not going anywhere. So that was a point. It's like, I have to get out. So I went on disability. I went on disability for 10 years. And then I started writing the book in 2019. So from 2013 to 2022, you know, I was basically on disability. And then I wrote the book while I was on disability. And then the last year and a half, I've kind of come back to life again. So at that time—
Welcome back.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks. I was just bereft. Like, I just did not know what to do. And a friend of mine who's an Ayurvedic specialist and also dealt with a lot of psychedelics, he said, well, because I was at that point, I was considering suicide. Like, if I have to live my life in a 12-hour panic attack every fucking day, I'm not gonna last. Like, I'm not gonna be here.
Sounds torturous.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. And I had tried, you know, that was the thing. That's why I have a bit of a negative reflection towards, you know, sort of psychiatry and stuff, because they never really helped me. You know, they had their things, and that's one of the reasons I wrote the book is there's so many people out there that are suffering and they feel like they're damaged because CBT isn't working for them or medications don't work for them or whatever. They feel like when I was a practicing physician, I remember getting a letter back from an oncologist and he said, the patient failed cisplatin therapy. And it was like just the language in medicine. I know I'm a little down on doctors today, and I don't mean to be that because I love medical doctors, but just the language, the patient failed therapy. Really? The patient failed? Really? And it's the same thing. The patient failed CBT therapy. The patient failed this. It's like, no. We failed, right?
They'll take the success, but not the failures.
Oh, it's terrible, which actually ingrains them deeper in this pharmacological model. Anyway, don't get me started on that. But back in 2013, my friend took me on this journey with LSD. And on LSD, as I was coming out of it, because when I initially, my mind was completely fractured, I had no idea like what the hell was going on. But as I was coming out of it, I got this message and I still don't know how, but it was like, hey, your anxiety isn't up here in your head. It's actually here in your solar plexus. It's purple, it's sharp, it's a pressure and a pain, and it pushes back onto your spine and into your heart, and it sort of radiates into your throat. It's like, oh, okay, well, that's interesting. And then I did ayahuasca after that, which kind of blew the back of my head off. That was, and both of the experiences were not pleasant. Like, I don't recommend psychedelics to people with anxiety. I just don't, because I think we're control freaks to start with. And when you take these things, like, you have no control whatsoever. So in the book, I say, you know, I kind of took one for the team on this one because it was just like, you know, but it got to show me that, hey, this is what's happening is that you're paying all this attention to changing your thoughts, and your thoughts aren't the problem. It's this alarm that's in your body. And then about 2 years after that, I went to an anxiety conference with Dr. Gordon Neufeld, who's kind of been my mentor in developmental psychology, because 80% of your brain development occurs before the age of 5 years old. And he said, all anxiety is separation anxiety. It's like, oh, wow, that was really interesting. And then I've added onto that since then, and it's mostly separation from yourself. Because I fundamentally believe that anxiety is a mind-body separation, but it's also an adult self-child self separation too. So the adult doesn't want to go back to the child because the child holds all their pain, bullying, shame, abuse, abandonment, neglect, all that stuff. So the adult doesn't want to go back and visit them. And the child looks at the adult and is like, hey, help me, help me. So that's where you get punched in the balls. Like, that's basically what the child is doing with the anxiety, or the alarm actually, is punching you in the balls saying, you can't live like this. It is truly a signal. So I developed this sort of theory that, oh, what if anxiety is more of an issue of alarm held in the body than the thoughts of the mind? And then I developed the theory behind it. I expanded on that. And over the course of 2019, you know, so I'm 6 years out from my traumas, then I started writing the book. And then I put the book out in 2020, and it's been really well received. It's going to be published in the US now by a major publisher and in the UK. So it is one of those things that I think people really appreciate this explanation, because I get messages like every single day that says, this is the first time someone's explained my anxiety in something that actually makes sense to me, like something that really feels right. So it's kind of like, okay. And that's where somatic therapy comes in. And again, I'm not against cognitive therapy. We need cognitive therapy. I did hundreds of hours of cognitive therapy. What I did find after I did the somatic work, after I really grounded in my body, all the cognitive work I did started to snap into place. It's like, oh, okay. But I don't think the cognitive stuff actually helps you heal. It helps you cope, but it really does solidify the somatic work, and it sort of helps ingrain it into your system so it becomes a new way of living, as opposed to just sort of, well, I have to be positive, I have to breathe, I have to do all these sort of things. So I don't know what your original question was, Scott, but I know I went off on that one.
My original questions was about dolphins, I believe.
Oh, yes, yes. We went into that before. We went into like a 20-minute tangent on that. So we can maybe spare the listeners that one.
We'll spare the listeners the dolphin.
The dolphin analogy.
The dolphin analogy. So that's interesting. I haven't heard other people talk about like, hey, maybe if you have severe anxiety, psychedelics may not be for you. Because, you know, I think there's kind of what I'm seeing more in the psychedelic world or the world of psychedelics medicine is that they're suggesting like, hey, there's something for everyone. This, whether it's ketamine or MDMA or
ayahuasca, peyote, yep.
Yeah, that they all have a different giving, we'll say, of medicine or a different approach that for all different types of conditions. So it's interesting that you talk about, and I'm not opposed to it, because I do think that not everyone is meant to do psychedelics, or that it takes a lot more preparatory work, often with somatics, and a lot of integration work, which is often missed, also with ideally with somatics and maybe even with cognitive behavioral therapy. Like the middle of the sandwich might be psychedelics, but a lot of the work happens before and after. And I think certainly I would imagine is what you might be saying is, a lot of preparatory work, if you have anxiety, is needed before you even venture into the world of psychedelics.
I mean, I think MDMA, which isn't classically a psychedelic, because I've done MDMA as well, and it's kind of like, and not at a rave. I've never been to a rave, although I want to go.
I'll go to a rave with you.
Sure, sure. You could take me to a rave. But MDMA is one of those, it's a rare chemical because it hypes up serotonin and dopamine at the same time. Because usually serotonin is kind of like the like here and now, like, oh, I'm so zen. I'm so like, it's the, like, I call it like the stoner chemical. Like, hey, man, that's really cool, dude. Whoa. And dopamine is like, okay, what are we going to do? Let's get going. Like dopamine is like Robin Williams. Like, there we go. So to get both of them at the same time, because you're still in control with MDMA, with the other ones, the true psychedelics, you're not. So I think that's not a bad place to start for people, because you just get filled with this sense of love. Like you just have this real sense of love for everything. Whereas the psychedelics is kind of hitting an ant with a sledgehammer if you're not ready for it. So, and I have had people have really good results with addictions from psychedelics, but not so much with anxiety, at least so far. So I think there's a cocktail that they are working on and coming out with that may be best for anxiety. But I usually recommend for people, it's kind of a last resort. MDMA, yeah, sure. Be prepared for that too. But psychedelics is really, when you're anxious, you're always looking at different permutations and what could happen and in control. And psychedelics completely take that away from you. Because I remember being on ayahuasca and my wife was with me at the time. And she says, I kept saying, there's nothing to hold on to. There's nothing to hold on to. There's nothing to hold on to. There's nothing. And it was a horrendous experience. It was easily I've had panic attacks, and this was, ayahuasca was 100 times worse than any panic attack I've ever had. And I couldn't get out of it.
You couldn't get out of it for 9 hours. Yeah. Yeah. That's intense. Oof. I mean, I think that's helpful for people to know that it's not a
panacea.
Yeah, it's not a panacea. Thank you. That was the word I was looking for, but was lost and out there. This show is also brought to you by the absolutely stunning and powerful tools for transformation that are created by Omala. Oof, even the name Omala transports you to a place of flow and vitality. These are some of my favorite products ever, like an amazing color-changing yoga mat that responds to your temperature and presence and reflects back your posture in real time. They have this incredible smelling skin balm candle that heats up to activate all the essential oils and vitamins that your skin has been craving for. I mean, look, if I could live in a giant bath of this candle, I would 100% do it. They also have these journals that lead you into a profound insight, and then you can plant those journals to create a stunning flower garden. I mean, damn, if that's not both deep and inventive, I don't know what is. If you're someone who desires to live in a luxurious flow of life and who believes in transformative wellness, then you have to check out Omala. Omala is giving my listeners an exclusive discount to treat yourself to something that is as special as you, boo. All you have to do is go to omala.com, that's omala.com, use the discount code DrScott10 at checkout, and a portion of every purchase goes to an incredible charity. You got this. To go back to the wonderful world of anxiety, or the popular world of anxiety, and by popular I mean like, we know that the data shows that there's a 55% increase from like 1990 to 2019 of anxiety, like diagnostic, like anxiety disorders. What the hell has doubled the anxiety rate in just that short amount of time?
Separation. Yeah. Like Gordon Neufeld always, Dr. Neufeld's words always echo in my mind, all anxiety is separation anxiety. And I think we're getting more and more separate from each other. Screens, especially with our kids, like our kids are addicted to screens, and they're never, you don't ever have to really deal with heartbreak or pain or loneliness. Like when I was younger, when I was a child, we never had, you know, it was one of those things that if you were bored, you had to freaking deal with it. Like you had to go into the shed and sort of nail some stuff together or whatever. Today, when there's boredom or any negative emotion, the kids just go to their phones and it just dissociates them out of it. So A, we're lowering their attention span, and B, we're showing them that uncomfortable emotion is to be avoided at all cost through operant conditioning. Like not direct, we're not teaching them that like, hey, in school here, don't do this. But it is one of those things where they never actually get to deal with negative emotion and sit in it and know that it's, you can't escape from it. You have to allow it to sort of wash through you. So if we're constantly leaving these kids in a place of limbo where they feel negative, so they go to their phone or their video games or whatever, they never actually get to deal with or learn how to metabolize this negative emotion. And if you can't metabolize negative emotion, then you're going to be in school going, you know, you can't say these words because these words freak me out and I can't. And that's what's happening in society. We're seeing exactly that. So that's one reason. COVID was another huge separation, you know, having masks. Like we have this social engagement system that Dr. Dan Siegel talks about, you know, eye contact, tone of voice, prosody of voice, body language, facial expression, all this stuff. When we have a mask on our face, a lot of that stuff is gone. Right. So there is this sense, maybe not consciously, but unconsciously, this person's a danger to me. This person is separate from me. And we have like, you know, a year and a half, 2 years of that. So that if you were kind of not dealing with negative emotion well before the pandemic, and then there was even more separation. So the key to healing from anxiety, you know, as a collective and as a single person, is connection within yourself and connection to other people. But we're not really getting to that. Netflix, you know, people are staying at home at night. You know, I drove downtown in my city a few months ago on a Saturday night, and there was freaking nobody downtown. 20 years ago, people would be at clubs and all that kind of thing. So it's one of those things that I think we're just getting more separate from each other, and we need each other. And the other thing is human currency is dropping. Like the reverence that we have for other people is dropping. And, you know, you see that in the States for sure. I mean, I'm Canadian, eh? So it's like, we don't see it as much here with, you know, we don't have the Republicans and Democrats and that kind of thing, but just the polarization and being fractionated out into, you know, pro-choice, pro-life, gun control, no gun control, climate change, no climate change. People are being factioned out into these things, and we're not coming together as a collective anymore. There isn't that sense that we're a cohesive unit anymore. you know, if you look at the 1940s and 1950s, yeah, people had differences for sure, but everybody was given a certain level of respect. We don't have that so much anymore. And I think that's one of the reasons why anxiety, depression, eating disorders, OCD, personality disorders, all this stuff, addictions to drama are increasing. You know, if you look at Trump and addiction to drama, like basically if you look at that thing, that's all addiction to drama. Like it really is. And it's addictive.
Yeah. So and if we were to like reframe it for a moment, because this is what I love to do, is to go, okay, so if anxiety is a signal, and the signal, the meaning of that signal is something is likely separated. Something in us is separated from ourselves, or there's a separation from our sense of environment or other people. And then if we follow the source of that signal back to home, like then we start to actually find more of that part that's feeling lost or unattended to or unconnected to. Is that kind of the approach?
Again, Scott, that's the thing about we kind of need some executive function in that. We kind of need that prefrontal cortex to go, hey, you're feeling unsettled. You're feeling negative emotion. That's okay. Can you find that and can you just stay with it rather than just immediately going into dissociation? And a lot of the problem with that is that our brains get wired to dissociate automatically. We don't even enter the stadium of being present because we don't see it. We don't even see it there. So it's so common to just, you know, distract into your phone. It's so common to maintain that separation or go into dissociation, which is even more separation because there's, as you say in your book, it's familiar. You know, it's a reenactment of probably what happened when you were younger. If you didn't get your needs met when you were a child, you'll probably default back to that. I have this little saying that says, you know, the word familiar can be broken down into two words, family and liar, if your family didn't connect with you. So you have this sense that what is secure, what is familiar to you is dissociation and disconnection. You will gravitate to dissociation and disconnected when you get stressed, which will of course make everything worse. So that's why we have so much more anxiety and depression these days is because we're learning to use those mechanisms as almost coping strategies. So it's just we're defaulting into this separation instead of unfortunately defaulting into something where we can see connection. And again, we need that prefrontal cortex to go, hey, punch you in the balls, to use that analogy, and go, look, you're feeling uncomfortable. What can you do for yourself right now? And sometimes I tell people, like, get angry, because angry will start mobilizing some of those like sympathetic chemicals that will allow you to actually make a change, rather than just going into this default place where everything kind of shuts down. And that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, because when you're shut down, you just can't connect.
Oof, it's a vicious cycle.
Yep.
It's a vicious cycle. And, you know, it's one thing to say, okay, the antidote is connection, but it's so important for us to play with the nuances here of going, there's so many things, technology, other people's challenges, our own challenges, our histories, our traumas that are working against that medicine of connection.
Yeah. And dopamine too. Like we're a very, very powerful immediate gratification society. So dopamine is one of those things that it's like, this will make you feel better. And it does, right? So who wants to sit in something that's uncomfortable, knowing that the greater good is going to be served when you can go for dinner? Or go on the internet or go on Amazon, you know, like that's the problem is that the brain, I love that book, Thinking Fast and Slow by Daniel Kahneman, because it's like we can make that executive choice if we decide, hey, I'm not going to eat that chocolate cake. I'm going to do something that's better for me. But it's so grooved to kind of just take the easy, the brain is lazy. Like it takes the easy way out. And we have to kind of, and that's why I say sometimes like get angry, because one of the things about anger is it diffuses victim mentality. And so much of anxiety is predicated on victim mentality. And when you bring up some anger in your system, you start alleviating some of those chemicals that are based in victim mentality. And then you can actually do something for yourself as opposed to just defaulting into, you know, zombie scrolling Instagram, which I do.
Well, thank you for like just making, normalizing it, because like, here's someone who's written a book about it. And this is certainly something I love on this podcast, especially is like when we go, hey, here's some experts, but they're actually humans, gently used humans, just like you, and just trying to do our best just to make it through this radical roller coaster we call life.
Yeah. And the stigma, you know, there's so much stigma towards mental illness and mental or nervous system dysregulation and that kind of thing, which of course drives people into more separation. Now, it's hard because especially, and I heard Brené Brown talk about this on Instagram, I was obviously scrolling Instagram. This man came up to her and said, you know, can you sign 4 of my books, like for 3 of my daughters and my mother or my wife? And we can't be vulnerable. Like my wife and my daughter would rather me die on that white horse than try to come off and just be vulnerable. And I think it's true, you know, especially with men, like men have a lot of anxiety, but they don't have the words for it either. So it comes out in aggression. It comes out in, you know, alcohol use, all this kind of thing. So it's one of those things like, how do we teach men to be more connected to each other? Now, men's groups are starting to come up that are becoming more popular, but it's such a huge issue, you know, because a lot of the angst in the world is put in by men who aren't being seen, heard, loved, and protected from childhood. And then we blame men for the very problem that we've created as a society. And, you know, that's another podcast. But it is one of those things that I see is that vulnerability is not welcomed for men. And unless you can be seen, heard, loved, and protected, and tears, you know, like Neufeld used to talk about the traffic circle, about, you know, how we get out of this horrible alarm is with tears. Like that's one of the methods. Like your pet is still dead. You're still getting a divorce. Like your external circumstances haven't changed, but there's something neurophysiological in tears that creates a different perspective on this thing on the external world that isn't changing. So the external world hasn't changed, but your internal perception of it has changed. And tears are one of the things that do that. But we shut those out of men when we're younger too. So, you know, the society's got a bit of work to do.
Yeah, just a little bit. So as we start to move towards a wrapping up, what would you say is like some of the things you have felt? I mean, just as a recap and a few other suggestions of like reconnect. What are the other things that are so significant for navigating and managing this pervasive experience of anxiety?
Yeah, I think it's just really, I was going to say control your physiology, but just flow with your physiology, right? Like if you're feeling anxious, that's okay. Where do you feel it? Can you breathe into it? Can you stay with it as opposed to distracting or dissociating into something else? Can you teach yourself to connect with the best parts of you? Can you talk to the younger version of yourself instead of one of the things that I think that you said in your book is that when you don't have a strong sense of self, the inner critic takes over, right? So, and I have this acronym called JABS, judgment, abandonment, blame, and shame. And when we have issues in our childhoods and they're not resolved, we can't blame our parents because they're these omnipotent figures that are looking after us. So we develop this inner critic that judges ourselves, abandons ourselves, and blames and shames ourselves. And if that's our framework, we're not going to be able to kind of rise into this place where we're connected to ourselves. So can you stop judging? Can you stop abandoning? Can you stop blaming? Can you stop shaming? Or at least allow those things to be there and allow them to metabolize and kind of see and relish the child in you, because the child in you carries your very best traits, even though you're probably judging, abandoning, blaming, and shaming them. And look towards that, saying, am I safe in this moment? Bringing yourself into connection. But just mindfulness isn't enough either. Mindfulness will also help you cope, but won't help you heal. It's really about finding that younger version of you and showing them that they are seen, heard, loved, and protected, and getting past the resistance, because we have a stigma towards our own child, the child that lives in us. So it's really slowly, and doing this in a titrated fashion, to kind of just slowly bring that child into belonging. I have a picture of myself when I'm like 12 years old, 8 years old, 4 years old, and it's around the house. And I just check in with that child, as woo as that sounds. But it's just finding that younger version of you. Dr. Bruce Perry, who wrote the book, What Happened to You with Oprah, talks about this neurosequential model of healing. And I think we have to go back to those dissociated parts of us that may have been 2 or 3 years old. And then we can start creating a new path rather than this reactive survival path that child had to take. But we have to go back to that point. We can't just fix things in our adult life now and expect that child to just sort of follow along naturally. We have to go back in this neurosequential model Because if you look at the way the brain, this is what fascinates me. If you look at the way the brain develops, like it forms as a neural tube. So initially, what is on the outside becomes the inside. So it's funny, almost like a philosophical way, is that the what's on the outside, which is what our outside environment, is now the inside, right? And then the brainstem develops. And if the brainstem, the bottom part of the brain that controls your body, doesn't develop properly, then the emotional brain that develops on top of that isn't going to develop properly. And if that doesn't develop properly, then the rational brain isn't going to develop properly. So we have to go back to that place, that childhood place, and show that child there is another way out. There is another direction that we can follow. And that's the way we heal. It's not just fixing your adult problems, because your adult problems are just a reflection of your childhood problems. All relationships are projection and transference. All relationships are projection and transference. And they almost always the child in us. So it's finding that child, seeing them, hearing them, loving them, and protecting them, which is, it's just a big feat, because we don't want to go back to our pain, like I said, but we have to do it. If we don't do it, we're always going to be juggling some kind of anxiety.
So let's heal that shit. Dr. Ross Kennedy, thank you so much for being on the Gently Used Human, guiding us through this process of healing.
Thanks, Scott. It's been great chatting with you. I love your book. I've listened to it twice. I will probably listen to it twice more. And yeah, thanks for the work that you do as well. Like I said, like before we went on air, it's nice to have a book that doesn't like deal with anxiety or depression or OCD. Like it comes at it at a very sort of approachable way, because we all know people who behave like this. And when you see it as a form of that, they're just trying to self-soothe, like they're just trying to get their needs met in whatever way that they weren't getting met as a child. So thank you for your book, and thanks for what you're doing in the world as well.
Thank you so much. And where can people find you, listen to you, connect with you?
Yeah, the Anxiety MD, not the Anxiety Doctor, the Anxiety MD. So Instagram, the Anxiety MD. My website is the Anxiety MD. Everything's the Anxiety MD. So I have a book called Anxiety RX. On Amazon, I also have a program called Your Mind-Body Prescription for Permanent Anxiety Healing, which has a yoga nidra in it and some meditations that kind of connect your adult self to your child self and your mind to your body in a better way than just kind of thinking about it. So I really love the program. It's been out for 6 months. There's 2,500 people in it already. So I'm really proud of it. And it's just my way of sort of giving back. You know, I dealt with a dad who was severely mentally ill. And I really felt sort of that he put a negative view into the world. And in a way, it's kind of my way, not of making up for that, but just saying, hey, Dad, you know, your pain meant something. I've used your pain and our pain to create something that really helps other people. And I think, you know, when I talk to my dad, he's been dead for like 35 years now. But when I talk with him, it's like, that's what I say, you know, like the book's doing really well. The program's doing really well. Like your pain meant something. Like your pain wasn't just in vain. So it really meant something. So thanks. Yeah, thanks for everything, Scott. Yeah, I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. And thank you for all of you who are tuning in to the Gently Used Human. Thank you for listening to the Gently Used Human podcast with Dr. Scott Lyons and friends. Visit gentlyused.com for fun extras, including submitting your questions for advice from a Midwestern mom. And don't forget to spill the tea and gossip about the show with all your friends and frenemies. And show some love by giving us 5 stars and leaving a review in your favorite apps. This helps us connect with all the other gently used humans out there. Oh, and by the way, you look fierce today.